Cokie Roberts, thank you for joining us.
Wonderful to be with you.
Great. You've written more than one book about the role of women in the history of our country. In broad terms, what have you found in your research about women's contributions that hasn't necessarily always been told?
Well, I think hardly any of it's been told. The books that I've written that are really solid history books are about the founding period, founding mothers and ladies of liberty. And these women were as essential to the creation of this country as the men were. And I think it's actually quite fair to say that the men couldn't have done what they did if the women hadn't done what they did. And not only were they keeping the home fires burning and supporting the family and all of that, but they were deeply, deeply political and very, very committed to the cause of separation from Britain. And they were very aware of it. Abigail Adams at one point said, you know, we women are really better patriots than you men because we are making all of the sacrifices and suffering all of the hardships for the cause. And if we win, you men will hold high office and be held in great esteem, and we won't even be able to vote. And so we're better patriots than you are. You've got to love that.
That takes a much bigger sacrifice, right?
Right.
And I know the people at the Seward House feel like there were many women in that family who contributed.
Absolutely.
As well.
I am working on a book right now on how the Civil War changed the lives of women in America, concentrating on influential women in Washington. And Fanny Seward, William Seward's daughter, was here with him and her mother and brothers when he was Secretary of State and before. And she was a schoolgirl originally, but then turned 18 in 1860. And she kept a wonderful diary. And it is very, very keen on explaining to you exactly what's going on in politics in Washington in that period. It's terrific. And she has a hair-raising tale of the night of the assassination when she was in her father's room when the assassin came in.
Well, that's really interesting. And how do you think that her story relates to, you know, the role of women you've seen, you know, in your time in Washington?
Well, I think that what it tells you is that they're part of a continuum and that they didn't just sort of, you know, arrive in the 1990s or the 21st century, that women have played a key role in public policy and particularly in social change from the beginning of the Republic. But of course, we now have women in much more explicitly powerful positions, and that's particularly true of your New York women. Mm-hmm. You know, first Hillary Clinton in the Senate and now Kirsten Gillibrand, who is really making the Senate pay attention to the plight of women in the military. And she is doing it in a way that is so interesting to me because it is something that a few years ago, I don't think you would have seen. You did have women in Congress, my own mother included, who were very aware that they had to carry the concerns of women into the legislature. But she's taken it even a step further to essentially say, look, you pay attention to me here. I am carrying the cause of women who have been harmed in our own military, and you aren't paying attention because you're not women. And it is a very interesting role, and she's playing it quite well.
And it's really changed the argument over that topic, I think.
Absolutely.
And what do you think about the way the role of women in Congress and other higher levels of government have changed the way Washington works?
Well, not enough. But what we have seen over the years is that even when there were just a few women in Congress, that they would get together and very explicitly and self-consciously put issues of concern to women and children and families at the top of the pile. And so that they would keep insisting that their male colleagues pay attention to things like pension reform or child care credits or child support enforcement or breast cancer research funds, things like that. But now what you have is women in both houses, because you now do have a critical mass, I mean, you know, 20% of the Senate and close to that in the House, of women who are saying, we don't like the way business is done here. And let's try to be more effective, more pragmatic, less ideological, more mature, grow up. And we really are seeing that of late, particularly we saw that in the government shutdown and all of that. It was no accident that of that bipartisan group in the Senate that got together, a large number of them were women, because the women are just simply more practical.
It's a long ways from when things got done over sort of a whiskey and a cigar, right?
Absolutely. But it would be useful if people trusted each other enough to get together and figure out how they could come together. But that is a very difficult situation here in Washington right now, and the women are the ones who do trust each other.
It's interesting. Now, I'm not going to ask you if Hillary is going to run for president or not.
The answer is I don't know any more than you do.
That's right. But she has been speaking out. She's been going around to different universities in our region, giving speeches and that sort of thing. So I guess my question for you is, do you think the country is ready for a woman president?
Sure. The country is certainly ready for a woman president. But it has to be the right woman at the right time, and her opponents have to be the right people to elect her. And, you know, in Hillary Clinton's case in 2008, her opponent was someone that made it very hard to elect her. But so it's impossible to know in any given time whether a female candidate can be successful. Obviously, the answer so far has been no. But that doesn't mean that it can't be true, because we're not ready as a country.
It's less about being a woman and more about just what the competition is in that given year.
Certainly, it would seem that the country would elect a woman as president, and that the election is about the whole atmosphere of the race and who the candidates are and all of that. On the other hand, we haven't elected a woman president, and so we can't really answer that question. And, you know, one of the things that's true is you can't poll on it, because if you say to somebody, would you vote for a woman for president, they all say yes. Oh, sure, fine. Or if you say, do you think the country's ready for a woman president, people will say yes, sure. So you have to ask questions in some sort of backhanded way of, you know, do you think your neighbor would vote for a woman president? Something like that. And actually, when that question was asked in 2008 in a Los Angeles Times poll, two-thirds of the people said that they thought the country was ready for a woman president, in however that was phrased. And three-fourths said ready for an African-American president. So that gap was still there. And, of course, we saw how it played out. So I assume that the country is ready for a woman president. They've seen women in so many jobs that are jobs of authority and high position. But I can't prove it until it happens.
And earlier this year, you moderated a panel on the role of first ladies, and I think we can't talk about women in public life without mentioning first ladies. How do you think the effect of first ladies has changed over the years?
I think they've always been the most powerful women in the land, and that's part of the point of my books. That starting with Martha Washington, they have been highly, highly influential and very involved in public policy, some more than others, some destructively, some constructively. But they have not been sitting around tending to the tatting until Eleanor Roosevelt came along. Far from it. Now, over the last few years, we've had first ladies who had public lives of their own before they came to the White House. And that does make for a different dynamic. But I don't really think that their roles are different from what they have been in the past. When I did that that panel, it was really just Laura Bush and Michelle Obama. And I was interviewing them in Tanzania at a First Ladies of Africa summit. And that really was remarkable, because here they were, you know, the immediate past first lady and the current first lady of different parties, and they came together and could not have been more gracious and more agreeable to each other and with each other. And part of the reason for that was that they saw themselves setting an example for those first ladies of Africa and essentially saying, you know, you can have a succession plan that is not death or jail, and it can be peaceful transfers of power where people can cooperate with each other. We see very little of that with the men, but the women were willing to sit up there together and make that point very clearly.
Well, we hope you have a great trip to our region, and we look forward to your continued reporting about women and men in politics.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to being there. Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us here this morning.